The Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has two matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 03-1111, City of Marshall versus City of Uncertain and others from Travis County and the 3rd Court of Appeals District. 030505, Citizens Insurance Company of America and others versus Fernando Hakeem Kokach and others from Travis County and the 3rd Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side, and we expect to conclude these arguments by noon. The court will take a brief recess between each argument. These proceedings are being recorded, and the parties may purchase a cassette tape of the arguments for a nominal fee in the clerk's office. There are currently two vacancies on the court, which we hope will be filled in the near future. The court is ready to hear argument in 03-1111, City of Marshall versus City of Uncertain.
May it please the court, Mr. Tom Ball will present argument with the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. In this case, the court has before it Water Code Section 11.122B. It's part of a major legislative initiative, essentially, to find water in Texas and get the water where it is needed. To accomplish this, the legislature saw that water marketing was a very important tool, and to make water marketing feasible and to facilitate it, the legislature adapted a principle, that this court had announced in the Stacey Dam case relating to new permits. The legislature took that and adapted it to the permit amendment process.
In your briefing, you don't mention Section 11.147. What is your position? Does it apply when you file to amend an application?
Your Honor, 11.147 is rolled into 11.122B in the sense that one of the parts of 11.122B says that if it doesn't cause any additional harm to the environment in the stream, and we think that is subsumed by 11.122.
Why isn't that a fact question?
Beg your pardon?
Why isn't that a fact question?
In some cases it may be, and we've never said that it's not, but in a case like the one that the court has before it right now, if you lay the application out next to the application for amendment out next to the pre-existing water right, the certificate of adjudication that Marshall had before amendment, and you consider what's on them, there's nothing that could affect anything any differently than the original right.
Let me give you a hypothetical. Let's suppose that, as I understand it, under 11.147, let's suppose you're in a different part of the state and the water source affects bays and estuaries, for example. And you apply, as I understand 1147, if I'm wrong, tell me, 11147, the commission can look at the priorities in the code in deciding whether they're going to allow the application or not. For example, the code gives priority to municipal use, and then there's lower priorities. Let's suppose the original applicant comes in with a low priority request, and this has an adverse impact on the bays and estuaries, so the commission says you can use it for municipal uses, but you cannot use it for one of these lower priority uses. We recognize there's going to be some damage. We balance out everything that 147 tells you to balance out. You get your permit, but only for municipal purposes. Under your construction, why couldn't the municipality then turn around and sell this excess water that it has to someone for a lower priority use, and then it would get no review at all on that balancing test under 147?
Well, I think, first of all, 11.147 is, as I said, it's our position that it's subsumed in 11.122B. So the questions that are in those other statutes, the legislature in this subsequent enactment of 11.122B laid those issues to rest, and what you have to consider is what's in 11.122B. But
under your analysis, all you look at is where they're taking the water out and how frequent it is, and you're not balancing the other factors that 147 has in there.
You're talking about 11.147.
11.147, priority of use versus ecological impact, that goes out the window under your analysis of 111.122.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, in considering the scenario that you posed, Your Honor, if a municipality gets an amendment for a certain purpose of use, they're still going to have to come in and get an amendment to change that use. So if you're talking about them selling it or they're selling it for some other purpose, they're still going to have to come back in through the amendment process.
Which is what's happening here. They're changing the purpose.
Well, but in this particular case, in the case before Your Honor today, what we have is a situation where they have a municipal right, and within that municipal right is contemplated industrial use. If you look at the definition
water.
And the rules.
Of potable water.
Of potable water. But then look at the legislature's full use assumption. If you assume, which you must under Marshall's municipal right, that it can use every drop, the issue that the respondents would like you to focus on, and I think where the question is coming from, Your Honor, is that you should be looking at the likelihood that more water is being used. That's not what the statute says. The statute says look at what Marshall could use under its existing right on
and the
its
commission
space.
Might say we're going to let an industrial user use potable water for municipal purposes, but we're not going to let them use it for one of these lower priority things in under 11.024. It's okay to damage the environment if you're going to use potable water for these purposes, but we think it's unrealistic that an industrial user would use potable water for hydroelectric power, for example.
Well, I think what the legislature did in the statute, Your Honor, is say, all right, let's look at the use that is authorized. And I keep coming back to that because I think that's what they did. I don't think that they have ordered the commission or required the commission to ignore those considerations. But what I think they're doing is saying, okay, somebody has a water right on the ground, like the city of Marshall, and they're asking for change. Now, is this change at all conceivably capable, given what Marshall could do under its existing right?
Well,
is it possible it's
going
to change
it? Could it really, though? I mean,
I'm sorry, ma'am.
Could it really do that? I mean, isn't the potability restriction, doesn't that have an economic impact that makes it really unrealistic that they would draw it down to the full extent?
This is the problem that we have with the Court of Appeals decision and with the position of the respondents. This likelihood issue to which you refer, Your Honor, is not something that's to be considered under the statute.
No,
the statute says full use.
But you seem to be equating full use with simply the amount of water they're allowed to draw and not the method by which they draw it.
Well,
and the method itself defines how much they're going to draw down if it's more expensive to draw it down or a more cumbersome process.
Well, see, I do think that's right in terms of their potential or their likelihood to use more water that they're authorized. We're not saying never have that in every single case. That let me see if I can give you an example. If I change a use, for example, and this is not before the court today, we're not arguing that it is, but let's say I change my use from a hydroelectric right that has no consumption at all attached to it, and I go to a municipal right, which by law entitles somebody to complete consumption, then obviously there is a question there that goes beyond the face of the instruments that the commission would have before it, beyond the face of the certificate that Marshall had and the application that Marshall filed. But in the other case that you posed, Justice O'Neill, what I think the question goes to is the likelihood that they would use it more because of the
really
economics.
It's not really likelihood. It's a very real restriction on use. Requiring it to be potable before it can be provided is a very real economic restriction on whether their ability to use the water. So it seems like you're just focusing on volume when the economics of getting it delivered the way you want to get it delivered is really what's driving it, and that's a significant change in use.
I understand that, but I have to keep going back to the statute because I know that you're saying there's a potential for there to be a different use that way. If it's economically feasible to use it more, for example, in the case of Marshall, where it might be easier to sell that water if it's not treated than it would be to sell it at treated levels. Is that kind of what you're referring to?
Well, I'm saying that you're reducing the price at which you can deliver it, and by reducing the price, you can deliver a greater volume quicker. Even though you're allowed to under your permit, with that restriction in place, you can't deliver that large volume at the same rate.
And I guess that is what is addressed in the full use assumption. And the full use assumption is not a bad thing. It's a good thing.
And I don't mean to...
No,
but
I don't.
But full use, as the permit contemplates, and the permit contemplates right now potability. And so it seems to me you're reading out of the full use requirement a very significant restriction on actual use.
All right, I see what you're saying, but I think that under that scenario that you would never have a shall grant amendment because you're always going to have something that makes it different, and that would give no effect to the shall grant language in the statute. I mean, there has to be a difference. Any change is going to cause some potential effect, the likelihood of some effect, but it may still be within the parameters of the existing right. What I think, again, the Court of Appeals decided and what the respondents want you to think is that this possibility of a difference because of economic reasons or something else, it makes a difference, and that it opens up the inquiry.
Well, let me kind of ask you, this case is here just on the question of whether or not there's going to be a contested case hearing.
Essentially, that's right.
Yes. And your position is, it's not quite clear what it is, I guess. You representing both Marshall and the state?
No, Your Honor. Mr. Townsend's going to get up. He represents
the
city.
Okay, so he's gone.
We just
he's gone. You're splitting time. Okay,
that's
didn't understand
correct.
That. Okay. Well, what's your position on whether amendments to permits are you required to have a hearing, contested case hearing generally?
If they entail an increase in appropriation, then they do. That's clear in the statutes that respondents say apply in this case, which we disagree with, do apply in that case. If it requires if they're asking for more water than they have,
other than this particular facts of this case, you're saying generally amendments to permits are entitled to a contested case.
I would say, I don't want to characterize it as generally, but I think a lot of them do. That's
and great. What you're saying in this case is because it's clear that they're going to lose, you don't have to hold a hearing. Is that your position?
Well, I think that it is clear that if you lay the application and the pre-amended right next to one another, that there's not an issue there.
Why can't that decision be made or properly made by the administrative law judge in some kind of summary dismissal in a lack of standing or failure to state a claim or summary judgment procedure within the contested case framework?
Because in the situations that fit within the statute, the legislature mandates the decision. And we disagree with the respondents and some of the amici to the extent that they say that there's either a statutory requirement or any other legal requirement that there be a hearing in this particular situation. First of all, we don't think that it's there under the Water Code because we don't think that the statutes that they have cited apply to amendments.
That's my question. What's your basic position on does the code ever require a contested case hearing on an amended permit?
I think in some cases that require an additional appropriation, which would also be called an amendment. That is, yes, one example. But if you're asking for more water,
this is an exception to the general rule.
I think yes, this particular case presents an exception to the rule that an amendment might require. I'm not saying that that's true in every case, that they require a hearing in every case.
Thank you, Sal.
Thank you.
Is the Attorney General going to argue?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is the Attorney General going to argue at this point?
I was with the Attorney General.
I'm sorry.
And Mr. Townsend is going to close, Your Honor.
Okay. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Craig Dean will present argument.
May it please the court, it is a great privilege for me to be here trying to bring some certainty to a statute for the citizens of uncertain that are here. My co-counsel is Rick Lowry, he's sitting with me at the council table, and I have any number of friends and associates in the audience looking over my shoulder and reading my papers this morning. First, I'd like to talk a little bit about the briefing on whether a notice and hearing is required here. I think based on Mr. Bowles' presentation here and the questions, I think we can be satisfied, particularly by the reply brief on page 7, that essentially they agree There can be disputed facts. If there are disputed facts, there would be a notice sent out and an opportunity to be heard.
The petitioners say they have sort of a challenge to you. They say neither the Court of Appeals nor the respondents have postulated any adverse impact on water right holders or the environment caused by the proposed amendment that would be greater than the impact caused by the full exercise of the existing water right according to its terms and conditions. They have not postulated one because none exists. And as I read your response, you say, well, no, there's at least one, which would be seasonal variations in the water being diverted. It might be more taken during the summer. Are there any others?
There, other than the seasonal variations, yes, the type of use that it's put to, I do believe, could have any number. And let me just advance to that to address your question. Much stock is put into the dam case of the Lower Colorado River Authority versus Department of Water Resources, but the court there itself said basically our decision is that the article prohibits double permitting or stacking of appropriated waters on appropriated waters. The case simply said nothing about the type of use that the appropriated waters would go to. And so just relying on that for the full use doctrine doesn't really answer all the questions.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, we seem to, again, assume full use means volume. And the underlying premise of the Attorney General's position seems to be that if it changes a purpose, that that doesn't affect use. And it seems to me an argument could be made that those are pretty inextricably intertwined.
Let me describe this because I use the seasonal use. Let me describe it this way. Accepting the permit, I believe it's on maybe page 7 of the TECQ's brief in response to our brief. They have a chart, and the chart says, well, if you look at this chart, here's the permit for the city of Marshall, and below it is the permit that Marshall wants to get amended to, what they want to do. And as you can see, there's no change on the amount of water to be used and the diversion rate of the water. The only thing we're changing over here is whether it's potable water for industry or non-potable water for industry. I look at the first two categories, the amount of water used and the diversion rate, to really be a they are functions of each other. I can pull out 16,000 acre-feet of water in 1 year. Now, I could pull it out in 1 month, I could pull it out in 3 months, I could ration my use and pull it out over the course of a year. I can determine how fast I pull that out by the diversion rate. I cannot take out more than 50 cubic feet per second. Well, arguably, if I run 50 cubic feet per second 24/7, my 16,000 acre feet disappears in 3 months. I'm finished. I can no longer take any water out of there. Or I can choose to do 10 cubic feet per second, and I can spread it out and maybe not use it up for the course of a year. But that is a bulk of water. You could change the use to industrial, and you could have a change in the pattern of usage from one that, say, for municipalities during the summertime, they approach 50 cubic feet per second, and in the wintertime when they're down by 10. You go to an industrial use, which isn't depending on the demand for their product. They demand it continually throughout, and you raise the use constant over the course of the year. It could be that the industrial use says, I'm going to get 16,000 acre feet from this lake, and I'm going to get 32,000 acre feet from that lake, and I'm going to get 40,000 acre feet from that lake, and I'm going to pull all 16,000 from this lake as fast as I can pull it. In fact, I think we use the example of a cooling pond. I'm going to begin my year, every year, by pulling out 16,000 acre feet within 3 months, and I'm going to fill my cooling pond, and I'm going to run it off my cooling pond the rest of the year. It seems to me that you cannot ignore the external factors on the full use doctrine. What is being measured is not 16,000 acre feet, 50 cubic feet per second. What's being measured is what external factors are affecting the use pattern that might have an impact on water rights owners or on the environment.
And yet, I assume you agree that if you were drawing it out at ten cubic feet per second, if you're drawing it out at 10 cubic feet per second, and you suddenly wanted to change to 30 because you had some other uses for it, as long as you didn't go above 50, you could do that.
No, the statute, 11.122, says if you're going to change the use of it, you've got to make an application for an amendment.
You have the same use, you just have more customers. If you had a greater municipal demand, you could change from 10 to 30, and there's
no application.
No application.
But that's not what happened here. They applied because they're changing the use. It might be helpful to look at the exhibit that I provided there on the first page to help. You know, I like pictures, so I use this. The argument essentially from Marshall and TCEQ is the legislature wanted to eliminate the hearing process. They want to eliminate the hearing process. We disagree. We read the statute. It says all of Chapter 11 that's applicable applies when you make an application. Interestingly enough, the statute does not apply if you ask for more water or a greater rate of diversion. Their argument says if you don't ask for more water, you don't ask for a greater rate of diversion of water, then we go right to the permit under the statute, because the statute doesn't apply in those circumstances. What the statute says is if you apply for a change, if there is no adverse greater impact, then you grant the permit. What is happening in the statute? It's deciding a question of law. It's deciding, as a question of law, what are you measuring for this greater adverse impact? What are we measuring from? There was an argument up to this point that City of Marshall only used 6,500 acre feet of water in any year, never approached 16,000, and therefore whatever was affecting the environment at that time is your starting point. And now if they want to sell it to industry for 16,000 acre feet, we've got to assess what the harm to the environment will be there. This statute settles the question of law. It says, no, you extrapolate 16,000 acre feet at the available usage, diverting usage, and you extrapolate what the environmental impact is on that, or the impact on the water rights holders.
I don't see that in the statute. It show me where in 122B. Mm-hmm. It seems to me the clear wording is that you contemplate full use, wide open, full rate, and then you overlay on top of that what environmental impacts would result from that overlay, from full use under that frame.
I looked at essentially the last sentence of Jeff O'Neill. What it says is you see a greater magnitude than under circumstances in which the permit that sought to be amended was fully exercised according to the permit's terms and conditions. So we take the permit, municipal use, potable water, and we say, let's assume they use the permit for its full use. What's the environmental effect? What's the effect on the water rights owners?
Okay, let me ask you this. If they did not seek an amendment and they were attempting to supply potable water to this sure. cooling pond at the maximum rate, would you be able to go to the commission for a hearing on how that would affect you?
They're not required to apply. They're not required to apply.
So,
because they're not changing the use. The statute says if they're going to change the purpose of use, you've got to apply. So what do we now measure whether there's an adverse impact that's greater than what existed? The question is, do we measure from their actual usage or do we measure what they could have done under the permit?
Let me ask you two questions. This kind of procedural. Now, if basically in the Court of Appeals you had a complaint about this interbasin transfer and that was ruled against you, and you basically waived that.
Right. We're not here on that.
So, but you did get a right to a contested case. And so if we rule for you, obviously it's got to go back to the commission, for a contested case.
I believe that's correct. Okay. There was actually competing summary judgment, but I assume it's a notice issue. There was no notice in the case or opportunity to be heard, so I'm assuming it ends up back in the commission.
So if we rule against you, what level does, do you have arguments left in the Court of Appeals? Do you have arguments left in the trial court, or do you want it, would it go, would you essentially be out?
Your Honor, essentially at the bottom line, our argument is not with them issuing a permit. Our argument is there are conditions that can be placed on the issuance of the permit that protect certain interests that are available. And as a matter of fact, that's what can happen here. There is no sense that you can go to a contest hearing, even if you show an adverse impact. There's nothing in the statute that says don't issue the permit. It simply gives the commission the opportunity to make such conditions on the permit as satisfies the concerns.
Can you give us an idea of that, both of the adverse impact and what conditions you think might be imposed upon adoption or approval of that amendment?
First, adverse impact. Texas Parks and Wildlife says that in this estuary, it is the estuary, its life cycle is dependent on seasonal activity. Now, when I say seasonal activity, understand, we're not backdating what Marshall does. And we're not saying that we're going to measure what Marshall actually uses and its effect on the environment. We're going to say, accepting the permit as it is, if they use 16,000 acre feet and they had whatever their usage was for 16,000 acre feet at 50 cubic feet per second, we then project what that effect on the environment would be. And now we're going to measure that against the industrial use. We suggest that because the city itself at 16,000 acre feet and at 50 cubic feet per second still has a pattern to its usage that creates a seasonal-like activity at this lake for the environment, for the flora and the fauna, that there will be an environmental impact if all of a sudden this pattern is now subtracted from the overall pattern of water use, water availability in the lake. That's the adverse impact for which there ought to be an opportunity to be heard on that to present evidence on it.
But the only difference in the equation is potability versus not, and that's really what you're looking at.
I'm not sure that's the case. That is an external factor. The cost of nobody's going to buy potable water to run it through piping to do cooling towers. So it's an external factor. I don't know if that's an external factor that TECQ would be considering or not. It might be a factor in usage. What our concern is that the industrial use levels out. The industrial use at 16,000 cubic feet acres of water.
That's okay under their permit as long as it's potable water. That's fully authorized.
But you take it as used. I mean, remember, as their permit exists, you can take out 16,000 acre feet at 50 cubic feet per second. You could take it out in 3 months. You could take it out over a year. What's the environmental impact of their usage, of municipal use? Municipal use, industrial potable, there are tons of information that people have studied what that use produces on the environment through the federal regulations and federal studies, EPA, state, environmental. There's tons of studies of what that use means. And all that this statute settles is the question of law. What is it you're measuring when you begin? We're measuring that municipal industrial potable use there.
That's a question for our time.
Let me ask you, I asked two questions, the adverse impact and then what conditions would you seek?
On the first application to amend a permit for water usage, There's the opportunity and requirement for the TECQ to ask for a conservation plan. What is the city going to do serving our natural resources, water being one of them? One of the opportunities here, and one of the things several of the parties are very much interested in here, is that Marshall update its conservation plan, which is a requirement that could be placed under the regulation statutes.
Did it file one with the amendment?
I'm sure it did file one with the amendment, but that's an issue to be contested.
The old plan?
They filed it with the old plan. I believe they did file one with this one, but the parties are interested in contesting that it doesn't go far enough. As I recall, there's some question about the new one. The argument is they only have to conserve when they're out of water. as opposed to conserving before they're out of water. So there's some things to issue, but that there will be a dispute over. But there are others who think there is a significant environmental impact, and the conservation plan, of course, plays into the remedy if there's a showing of a greater adverse impact than what existed in the original permit. There's the opportunity now to work on a plan that ameliorates that greater impact.
Does the potability requirement affect the pattern of use?
I haven't looked at the studies. My guess is money makes a big difference. And potable, of course, is way too expensive. So there'd be virtually, I think as an economic matter, there's very little industrial use if it's potable, because there's just industry doesn't find a need for potable water. It's very expensive.
Well,
so they
suppose Coca-Cola or Anheuser-Busch moves in a huge plant, and they want a lot of potable water, and people drink more Cokes or beer in the summer than they do, which is going to have exactly the same effect as this power plant, even if it's all potable. Certainly possible, it is.
I guess that begs the question. They apply for a change of use. We wouldn't be here if it was Coca-Cola coming in on the plant, and there's no question that is
Coca-Cola and Anheuser-Busch are people, not industries. It seems like an industry to me.
11.122 does not apply when there's not a request for change of use, and that would not be a change of use. There was an application for change of use from potable to non-potable. All, in answer to Justice O'Neill, there are studies of municipal use, and I assume studies of industrial use of potable water, by which we can project what 16,000 acre feet at 50 cubic feet per second diversion rate would produce from municipal use, potable use by industry, and compare that to industry that doesn't need potable water, and what impact 16,000 acre feet and 50 cubic feet per second affects on that in terms of this is there, you know, a spike in the use and less use, or is there a flat use that eliminates some of the activity in the wetlands?
Well, that's my question, is about the potability affecting the pattern of use. I mean, I can't help but picture a pipe with water coming out of it that has a screen on it, and the water comes out at a certain rate with the screen on it, and they want to take the screen off, which is going to let it come at a higher rate. It's still within the rate of what they're allowed to do under the original permit, but by taking the screen off or changing the use, is it your argument that will affect the pattern of use?
I'm not an expert, Ms. O'Neill, so I don't know. There is some discussion about return rate flows.
But what I'm asking is, you seem to be saying that the adverse impact is the change in the pattern of use.
Yes, Your Honor.
And unless that's caused by removing the potability requirement, then I don't understand the relevance of that.
I guess that's what I'd say. That's a fact determination.
So you would say that the potability requirement affects the pattern of use?
I would argue we have the opportunity to show that it affects the pattern. You can't assume that it does not, which is what they would like to do.
Can you think of any change in use that wouldn't raise a fact question?
It is difficult for me to say, can I think of a change in use that wouldn't raise a fact question? I could think of changes in use that wouldn't that no one would request a hearing on.
Well, but I mean, I can too, but they just went home. But assuming that they requested one and said, this is going to change it one way or the other, less, more, there's going to be more diversion, more return, we want a hearing. Wouldn't you essentially always have a hearing on the adverse impact?
I think that's entirely possible, Your Honor. If you look at the second page of the exhibit I passed you, that's essentially TECQ's position. TECQ's position is that adverse impact has been eliminated as a fact question by the full use doctrine. As a result, is this a full use doctrine? Full use assumption case is what TECQ would say. If it is, therefore, no notice, no hearing, amendment approved.
Justice Smith.
Ask you one last kind of procedure question. Now, that there's an administrative decision, March 15, 2002, I believe, that settled this thing. That was administrative action. It wasn't a contested case decision. Okay. Right. And then you filed your clients filed a petition for judicial review in Travis County Court.
Yes, sir.
That's what we're at. So my question is, what's the standard of review of the agency action? Is it de novo? Is it substantial evidence, arbitrary and capricious? What are we looking at with regard to the decision that you're complaining about?
Your Honor, it would be, in my opinion, it is not obviously not substantial evidence. No evidence was taken. In my opinion, I think it's de novo review. Does the statute require notice? Does the statute require the opportunity to be heard? The argument is that 11.122 eliminates the fact issue to be heard, but as you heard from Mr. Ball today, they understand if there is a fact issue, there would be notice, there would be an opportunity to be heard. The argument here is there a fact issue? We think that 11.122 solves a law question about what you measure to determine if there's an adverse impact. It does not dispose of the fact question of whether there's an adverse impact.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Orlando Townsend will present a vote for the petition.
Well, good morning. I have 8 minutes, and I'd like to answer every question I heard this morning. I don't think I have time to do that. But I do want to address what we are dealing with, and that is the interpretation of an amendment in a statute that was part of Senate Bill 1.
It says 122B, says subject to meeting all other applicable requirements of this chapter for the approval of an application. And your briefing takes a position that some of the requirements for applications apply and some don't. Where do we find within the statute itself directions on how to pick and choose?
You find the statute in the terms applicable. When Section 11.122B states that a presumption of full exercise of the existing permit, in that consideration, will the change go beyond the full exercise of...
But you still got the... That's still expressly subject to other applicable requirements,
right,
for the approval. And you say some apply. For example, I think you say that you do have to file conservation plan. Did you file a conservation plan?
Yes, we did file a conservation plan. Every water right holder, every water right purveyor has to have a conservation plan.
Section of the Act do you think you're required to do that?
11.127.1. And that provision was added to the Water Code in 1985. And people have conservation plans. And the agency has to, it's just impossible for the agency to every year accept everyone's conservation plan. So in part of Senate Bill 1, when they amended 11.121271, they said anytime you come through the door, present your conservation plan so we can make sure that it is consistent with the then applicable regs.
Why shouldn't that have to be subject to notice and hearing if anybody has an objection? I mean, aren't there fact questions presented on whether your conservation plan is adequate or not?
The conservation plan is to comply with the commission regulations of what is required in a conservation plan, and that's a ministerial check the boxes. It's
so
not
you
a contested
could file,
case.
We have no conservation plan.
No,
that's our plan.
No.
And that would fly.
No. You would say, is your conservation plan consistent with the commission's rules
Why can't there be fact questions there?
Because you have to make your conservation plan consistent with what the rules require.
Shouldn't people be able to say, Commission, we don't think it complies because, isn't that...
That would be an enforcement matter. Because all the conservation plan has to do is comply with those regulations and make the statements and the requirements that are of that regulation.
Let me ask you a question. When you filed this application, it was granted. Okay. So say if it was denied by the commission, would you argue that you had a statutory right to contest the case here?
If it were denied because it felt it went beyond
just
the bounds.
Any reason. Well, I've got a good application. They said, no, you don't. They say that's final. You say, no, I get a contested case hearing under Chapter 11.
I would say that if the commission thought it was beyond the bounds of my existing right, then Section 11.122B was not applicable, and I would be bound by the rules of the agency that govern action on applications. The commission has rules that say how they're going to deal with applications to amend permits. And the rules say no notice is required if your permit or your amendment request is within the bounds of your existing permit.
Under the rules, you would be entitled to a contested case hearing.
Under the rule, I would be kicked out of the 122B amendment situation. So you don't qualify for a 122B amendment. You're some other kind of amendment, and I would follow the rules under that type of amendment. I couldn't get, so that would be my situation. Now, to answer the question about the permit and the change from potable to untreated water.
But I want to ask you another question.
Excuse me.
Under 11.134B4, it says the applicant has provided evidence that reasonable diligence will be used to avoid waste and achieve water conservation. I presume you did that with the original application.
Correct.
Did you do it with your amendment?
Your Honor, I believe when the legislature said in 11.122B, you will assume full exercise of the existing permit, all of those questions have been decided under the existing permit.
That's exactly my question, because it seems to me, at least logically, that avoiding waste and achieving water conservation is putting a potability requirement on, for starters, and that if you take the potability requirement out, that's got to have some impact on the evidence of waste and evidence of means to achieve lack of waste and conservation.
Well, so, Your Honor,
it seems like taking potability off might tend to increase.
I respectfully disagree in the sense that if it was Anheuser-Busch or Coca-Cola and we sold up to the maximum and it was drinkable water, there'd be no difference than if we sold up to the maximum within our diversion rate.
I agree with you, but if you take potable off, somebody else can come in and do that.
That is trying to compare some assumed current condition versus the change, and that's what the legislature said in this presumption you don't do. You assume full exercise of the existing right. Marshall's existing right does not have any seasonal limitation or pattern of use limitation.
Getting back to my example, let's suppose you're in a different part of the state and the commission expressly would deny you the right to take 16,000 feet out for industrial uses, non-potable, because it impacts the estuary. And I said, no, you cannot do that. We're going to give you a permit only for municipal and industrial potable purposes. And you turn right around a year later and say, well, I've got the right to take 16,000. Now I've come in with an amendment. I want the potable requirement out. And the commission said, no, we'll let you do it for potable purposes. We're not going to let you do it for non-potable. It seems to me you're making end run around that determination.
Well, Your Honor, I think if that were the case, the agency would put restrictions such that the terms and conditions wouldn't allow somebody to turn around and overcome that decision. If the agency said, we don't want anything but municipal use, there would be an additional term or condition or restriction that you couldn't then overcome, because if you applied the full use under those terms and conditions, it would cause a greater impact. So I believe it really, you have to look at the permit you're dealing with, and you have to follow the legislative directive to assume full exercise according to the terms and conditions of that water right. And it's not what they may do or could have done. It is that water right under those conditions. And that's what the legislature is trying to do.
Well, it is, in fact, though, you're removing a restriction. Your amendment seeks to remove a restriction.
It changes the purpose of use. Yes, yes,
it
yes, ma'am,
the
it does. It is potable. We want to do it.
And the removal of that restriction may have effects.
Not more than the full exercise.
We don't know that.
Well, if
you're
you
only
can,
looking at volume.
Well, I'm looking at volume. I'm looking
and
at flow rate and entire consumption. And what more can be can an effect be when there is no restriction for what time of the year it can be consumed?
No, but there's a restriction on use. And that's, I mean, it seems to me that your position just ignores that restriction. It seems to say that we can come in and remove all the restrictions this was originally permitted under, as long as we don't exceed the volume or rate of flow.
You don't exceed the volume, the rate of flow, or the other terms and conditions. And here we don't have a condition or a term limiting the amount of the consumption it can be in its entirety.
So you can't have an adverse impact unless you affect rate or total amount.
In Marshall's situation, that's correct.
You can or can't have an adverse impact other than flow rate and total amount.
In Marshall's?
No, I don't. I'm not limiting. See.
Well, because
this is
there's
the Supreme
other terms
Court. We write a rule, and it doesn't apply just to Marshall. We can't have one rule for Marshall and a different one for Lufkin. So we're writing a rule that's going to apply to their neighbors and to El Paso and everybody else. You have to admit, because otherwise the statute is duplicitous. The statute says the same thing twice. If the only adverse impact is when you increase the amount or the flow, there was no reason for the legislature to put in, after accepting out something that increases amount of flow, to say also if it has no adverse impact.
The legislature did say, according to its terms and conditions, and there could be, if you wanted to change, it may not be the volume, and it may not be the rate, but you may have a condition that requires a return flow amount. And if you change that, what you want to do is change that. That could have an adverse impact. And what we have here in Marshall, we don't have any such restriction. We don't have any seasonal restriction. We have no condition on consumption.
Let me ask you, now, if the Court of Appeals said it has to be a contested case, and if we affirm that, this is going to go back to the Commission for a contested case. Now, you're saying the Court of Appeals was wrong. Say we go in your way. What's your view as to where this case should go? Should it go back to Court of Appeals, back to trial court, or back to the Commission?
It's decided at this level because the question I think presented is...
There's nothing left in this case. If
there's nothing left in this case is because it is whether the Commission's interpretation and application of Section 11.122B and the remainder of the Water Code to Marshall's amendment application was reasonable and consistent with the plain language of the law.
So you request a take-nothing judgment from this court if you prevail.
If we prevail, the grant is affirmed. The agency's grant of Marshall's amendment would be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. Any further questions? The cause is submitted, and the court will now begin.